listening to Miller and Moulton, exclusively on the Florida Sports Network. And now, here's Mark Miller and David Moulton.
It is the final hour of Miller and Moulton for those of you in Lake City and surrounding areas, Tampa, St. Pete, Port Charlotte, and Venice. If you're in the 239, you know we are just halfway home. Miller and Moulton here on the Florida Sports Network. Kurt Becker to join us in about 20 minutes to preview this Saturday's Kentucky Derby. Keith Smith to join us in about 40 minutes to discuss some of the NBA playoffs and also Ben Simmons news from yesterday. That was quite significant. But Pat Kerwin's kind enough to join us once again a day earlier than normal. Moving the chains weekday afternoons on NFL Radio. Pat Kerwin's appearances are brought to us courtesy of Pinchers, from Tampa to Key West and a dozen plus locations in between. Pinchers, because you can't fake fresh. How are you this Thursday, Cinco de Mayo?
I'm doing fine, and still reviewing the draft and kind of switching gears as well to looking at who would I scout this summer on these rosters, the 5th, 6th, and 7th round picks. You got to make sure that you see them all summer in case they try to slip through the practice squad, especially if you had a high grade on them. And then where the teams have surplus of players that you know they're not going to keep them all. So just dabbling in that a little bit because people are going to start asking, hey, where do we find a running back? You know, those kind of things. And teams that have 6 running backs on their roster, usually the 4th guy is vulnerable, especially if he's making a little money. So just that kind of stuff. Nothing big, just that.
Also, I would imagine this is where, with finding these, whether holes in the roster or extra in the roster, is trying to figure out where the rest of these free agents are going to go, correct, Pat?
Yeah, and, some of them still have leverage. Jarvis Landry, I think, he may not be able to get $20 million, but he should be able to get a decent deal. Tyrann Mathieu's deal kind of indicates that there's still some money out there. Maybe not the most money, but more than people would think. And then I had that list of 60 free agents that I really put together like April 1st, and there's 45 of those guys still left. The mini camps and the OTAs, they're going to be nightly meetings literally every day, reviewing the guys, and they'll start cutting guys they know shouldn't be in camp. And I'll say this, the guys that are going to get cut first, the guys that are always on the ground. You go out to practice in shorts and helmets, anything like that, and you're constantly telling some undrafted kid or a late-round pick, get off the ground. You basically decide, let's get him out of here before he gets a good player hurt.
You mentioned Tyrann Mathieu signing with the Saints. You know, Pat, we've been pointing out for a while now, they're not backing down from the Bucs. They don't think that they're in a rebuild at all. They think they have a championship defense and that Michael Thomas and Jameis Winston both were hurt for large portions of last year. And they think it's still their division, especially since they've swept the Bucs the last 2 regular seasons. When you look at the Saints, do you see a viable division contender and a viable, NFC championship-type team?
Well, 2 questions there. Do I see him as a contender? Yes. Mickey Loomis just won't put a team on the field that he doesn't think can contend. He's pretty aggressive in that area. Super Bowl contender, no, because you're pushing Jameis over the line that I think he can get to, in my opinion. I think Jameis might throw for a bunch of yards, and I think he could win more games than they lose. But I don't think at the end of the day, when we get down to late December, January games, that he's going to be one of the big-time quarterbacks.
When you look at the Bills right now and you're going through those free agents, are there still holes? I mean, they seem to be, right now to me, the most complete AFC team. Are there holes on that roster that they still need to fill?
Not holes. I think they are, Mark. Your point is they're solid starters. The backups are quality players. There's room for some of these rookies. And then they have Brandon Bean, who's, if there's a hole, they would fill it quickly with all the veterans that are out there. You call a veteran and say, hey, I'm Brandon Bean. We'd like to bring you to Buffalo. And it's August 10th or something. You're jumping on a plane as fast as possible because they're a good team. And you can make some money in the postseason. But I see them as pretty complete right now. Again, they're a team that's not going to have to cut guys to you know, make the roster safe, but they might get an injury or two. They would act pretty quickly to grab a veteran. And I think, you know, it's hard for some teams to call those veterans, Jarvis Landry, as he knows, hey, would you like to come here? He has great enthusiasm for the Jets, but I think everybody, as an example, looks at them and says, 2 years from now, the Buffalo Bills do not have to sell the opportunity that exists in Buffalo.
Pat, you mentioned something earlier about already starting to look at teams' training camp rosters and figuring out who could be a guy that teams are going to try to sneak through on the practice squad. If you're the GM of a team that just had a top 10 pick in the draft, couldn't I almost make the case that, I mean, if you wanted to, you could trade away your sixth and seventh round picks because you're going to be grabbing good teams, fifth, sixth, and seventh round picks off of the waiver wire, if you will. Like, you know, the Ravens just drafted 37 guys. I mean, they can't all make the team. I mean, if you're running the Giants or the Lions or something like that, you could have a field day on cutdown day, couldn't you? Just taking good organizations, fifth, sixth, and seventh round picks that they're trying to sneak through and just grab them and go, well, hell, this is better than we got.
Yes, I agree with that. And you used the right team to talk about. So they had a nice little running back in the sixth round, Tyler Batty. They would look at that group. If their good running backs are all healthy again, they're going to think you're trying to slip Tyler through. You might have a grade on him that had a fifth-round grade or a fourth-round grade, and you didn't get a chance to take a running back, and now you have a college free agent guy, and you see them trying to slip Tyler Batty through, you'd claim him pretty quickly. They did bring two tight ends in. I think they're going to keep both Kolar and Isaiah Likely. But you then look at the roster and say, wait a second here. Look at their roster. There's a veteran tight end that may not make it now. So Nick Boyle, I think, and I like Nick Boyle, but if you think they're going to keep the two fourth-rounders, which I believe they would, plus they've got Andrews, you start thinking maybe Nick Boyle is tradable, maybe Nick Boyle is going to get waived, those kind of things. So you're not in the business of predicting it. You're just in the business of preparing for it. And you might, if you're friends with some of these GMs, like what I had close friends, I'd call and say, hey, we're going to watch Nick Boyle all summer. Is that a waste of my time? Are you thinking he's on the bubble? And he might say, well, I can tell you if he's on the bubble if you tell me who's on your bubble. So you'll end up trading that kind of stuff.
And, you know, Pat, it seems that obviously we're getting more of this because it's a whole new group of GMs that have come in. It's a younger group. They're more willing to trade. They're more willing to take gambles. I mean, we are entering a new era with the general managers, aren't we?
Well, I think there's some history of trading anyway, but the point I'll make is at the end of the draft, 262 picks, how many teams that were in the original spot were no longer in that spot when the choice came? It was 96, might have been 98, but just run under 100. Teams were not in that spot when it was time to make the pick. So, to your point, Mark, guys are moving around a bunch. But I think it says a lot, too, about this draft. As much as it says young GMs are ambitious, I know some young GMs are scared to death to trade. And they feel like if it's their first wave of trading, now the media in their town's critiquing them. And the owner might be bringing them in going, you know, a lot of people thought, Minnesota-Detroit, right? They had a big trade in division. And if you look at the trade chart, Minnesota was short about 230 points. That doesn't mean you have to live by the chart. But already people are calling my show going, hey, Minnesota, they got the short end of that deal. Well, that's a young GM. You know, you'll start to respond to those kind of pressures. And so it does change. But 96 to 98 different teams at different spots among the 262. I think it says this, Mark, more than anything. The draft boards were certainly all different in all 32 towns. I always call them fingerprints. But it just tells you people had a particular player they wanted, and they were going to move two or three spots or four spots or five spots to get the guy they wanted because the draft was full of guys that were particularly interesting to certain teams and not others.
Pat, in our remaining moments here, the Eagles, they did a lot this offseason. They finished three games behind the Cowboys. The Cowboys swept them last year. How close do you think Philly has gotten to Dallas in the NFC East?
Again, they're a team. Like, I'm cheering for Jalen Hurts. It's hard not to like the guy. We all kind of like Jalen. He kind of has a great story, and he had to leave Alabama and the rest was history at Oklahoma. And really, did he get the job in Philly because he was great or because they didn't like Carson Wentz? And so this is the moment of truth for him. They fortified the roster, and he's got a lot of pressure on him. Philly will turn on you in a minute. I think you guys know that. But he's your favorite son right now, but that kind of pressure, I found it very interesting that they fired an awful lot of personnel people yesterday and the day before.
Pat, with Miami, how close are they to Buffalo, and how far away do you think they escape from New England, or have they not at all?
I don't think you ever escape from New England. Everyone likes to criticize that draft, Chattanooga guy, and he wasn't particularly good. We had Paul Alexander on yesterday. I had Paul with him. I brought him to the Senior Bowl to study the linemen, and Strange was there. And Paul is pretty conservative in his comments. He did not think he was a first-round pick. He said, I think the guy doesn't even have a first-round body. So a lot of people are down on New England. But the rest of their draft was fairly predictable. I think the biggest mistake everyone in the AFC East makes every year is that they think they're finally passing New England. And then New England reminds them, maybe not head-to-head all the time, but when it comes right down to the final record, you never really get away from Belichick. So, and I don't think Miami's gotten away from him. A nice-looking football team. Shuffle the deck in the offensive line, reconfigure it to the way it might be the best five on the field, and some guys might switch positions. But ultimately, Tua's got to have to figure out how to handle a Belichick defense when it counts most, which would probably be a postseason game.
He's Pat Kerwin. Moving the Chains, weekday afternoons on NFL Radio, and he joined us once again courtesy of Pinchers. From Tampa to Key West and a dozen locations in between, Pinchers, because you can't fake fresh. Pat, thanks for everything this week. Enjoy the rest of your week and weekend.
Take care, my friends. Have a good weekend.
Pat Kerwin joining us once again here on Miller and Moulton. I'm curious. Just Dolphins, Eagles, Saints, teams like that. Have they closed the gap? And if so, by how much?
Welcome back to Miller and Moulton, only on the Florida Sports Network.
Past the hour, Miller and Moulton, the Florida Sports Network. Keith Smith will join us. Talk a little NBA in 20 minutes. Kurt Becker is kind enough to join us once again. Horse Racing Radio Network. Follow Kurt on Twitter at Becker Trackside. Becker Trackside. Kurt, it's David and Mark. Hope you've been well. How are you?
All is well. Good to be back on the show again, gentlemen. It's good to catch up and talk a little racing.
Is this a full field, 20 horses? Good field? Below average? Really good field? What do you think?
It's really difficult to say. I'm a person that believes it's tough to say how a three-year-old crop really ranks until later in the year when we see who gets through the summer and who's still around at the end of the year. I will say this. My instinct is that this is a good crop. I think you could legitimately make a comparison to maybe 2007. It might be the best crop in 15 years, at least as of this day. That's my take on it. You think back in 07, you had Street Sense, you had Hard Spun, you had Curlin, and I think that this history might look at this crop the same way.
Well, that's a fantastic preview for the race when you're talking, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of times in the last couple of years. Yeah, there are upsets, Kurt, but we've always had, you know, a couple of horses to choose from. How many different potential winners do you see in this Derby field?
This is a field where when I sit down and take a look, I can make a case I'll bet you I could make a legitimate case for probably seven or eight horses at least in this 20-horse field that would have a legitimate shot to win. I think that you've got a combination of horses that can sit off the pace and can make an impact. You've got horses that I think for the first time in a while, you've got a horse or two that are capable of coming from off the pace and actually getting there and winning the race. So we've not seen that in a long time, guys. We've gone through several years where it's almost gotten bland and predictable that a horse who breaks on or near the lead stays there, goes all the way and wins the race, and the horses that come from off the pace just don't get there. I think this year could be different. I believe some of those late closers could have a shot to actually make an impact.
All right, two horses that opened at below 5-1. Bluegrass winner Zandon was the 3-1 favorite. Louisiana Derby winner Epicenter was 7-2. Do you agree with that? Do you think that they are the two best horses in the field?
I think they are. If I had to pinpoint maybe something that is at least a minor surprise, I've told anybody that asked me over the last couple of weeks, well, who's going to be the favorite to the Derby? I've generally said Epicenter because he's been consistent. He's won 4 out of 6. He lost by a head in the LeCompte at Fairgrounds this year, came back, won the Risen Star, and then really looked good in winning the Louisiana Derby. So when Chad Brown's colt was made the morning line favorite, Zandon, I was surprised about that because, if nothing else, Epicenter has won a couple of stakes. And you look at Zandon, who looked great in Keeneland, winning the Bluegrass, but he's only got one stakes win. And I think if you're looking for a vulnerability with him, maybe that's it, although he did take a big, big step forward in that most recent start.
Zandon, the 10-post mark, and Epicenter, the 3-hole.
And, Kurt, you know, White Abario at 15 is the lowest odds, but it looked like not only do we have a field with a lot of contenders, but none of the contenders drew anything really far outside that puts them in a hole. I don't know if White Abario can do anything from the 15, but looking at 16 through 20, these aren't horses that are considered horses that can win the race. So not only do we have a good race, but it seems that the good horses got pretty good draws as well.
I don't think there was any real significant impact from the draw. I totally agree with that. The draw is always interesting. I was reading the other day where 40 years ago, and I'm dating myself here, but Gato del Sol pulled a big upset in the race. He had not really overwhelmed anybody. He hadn't won a race all year. And he drew the 19-hole. And back at that time, Churchill had an outdoor ceremony under a tent when they would do the draw. And Arthur Hancock III, the co-breeder and co-owner, when Gato del Sol drew the 19-hole, Arthur got so frustrated, he reared back and he kicked one of the support poles holding up the tent and broke a toe. And then Gato del Sol ends up pulling like a 20-1 upset that day. But no, guys, I agree. And I think the other key about the draw, it seems like a lot of your speed horses, the early speed all drew around post position 3 to post position 8. Maybe the biggest outcome from the draw is Epicenter. He drew post position 3, and he's a horse who can either go right to the lead or sit back off the lead. And I think part of the conventional wisdom is jockey Joel Rosario, he might not have any choice drawing down toward the inside. That might have made up his mind for him. He might just have to pull the trigger right out of the gate and maybe take Epicenter right to the front and try to go all the way.
Kurt Becker, Horse Racing Radio Network. Follow him on Twitter at Becker Trackside. All right, I'm a huge New York Rangers fan. Mark Messier delivered the Rangers the Stanley Cup. Messier is in the field with John Velasquez, who's won the Derby 3 times. 8-1 odds. I'm told this horse has never run this distance. Kurt, what are Messier's chances?
I think Messier's got a good chance for a couple of reasons. Number one, you just touched on it. John Velasquez is the jockey. I mean, John's a guy that he's won 2 editions of the Derby.
and he was first across the wire with Medina Spirit last year, who, as we all know, that's turned into quite a mess since then. But John Phil has, as of now, he's got two Derby wins that still stand up to his credit. And Messier is by Empire Maker. I mean, Empire Makers, they can run all day. They love a distance of ground. There are people who are criticizing the horse because he's only 1 for 3 going around 2 turns. But I keep saying, go back and look at his breeding. He's bred to go a distance of ground. I think the stat is a little bit deceiving that he's lost 2 out of 3 going around 2 turns, if only because I believe 2 of those losses came at Los Alamitos, and that is a track that that horse just really did not like. He did not take to it. And you've got him and you've got Taba, that both had been trained by Bob Baffert. Now they have both been moved to the barn of his former assistant, Tim Yakteen. So many people are so high on Taba, the Santa Anita Derby winner who beat Messier. My concern about Taba, this is only going to be his third career start. The horse is probably going to be overbet. And, guys, how often do we see it? When you get two horses coming out of California, both from the same barn, so many people get hung up on one and they ignore the other all week. I think Messier is a dangerous horse because so many people are – they dismissed him because Taba beat him in the Santa Anita Derby.
And Taba, ridden by Mike Smith in the Derby, and we know his success there. All right, Kurt, who do you like in the Derby, and how do you see this race shaping up?
I think there will be a lot of speed in the race, and I think for the first time in probably 9 years, you have to go all the way back to Orb to find a horse back in 2013 that came from well off the pace to win it. I think we're going to see that this year, and what that means for me, I think the two horses that are going to be running late are going to be Zandon and Mo Dunnigal, the Wood Memorial winner. So, what I really like, I'm putting Zandon on top. Yeah, I'm a bit of a homer here. He came out of the Keeneland race meet where I work in Kentucky. But what I like about Zandon, he got a tough trip. He got beat and bounced around turning for home. He bounced off a horse to the left. He bounced off a horse to the right as he was trying to work his way through traffic. And what I like is it never knocked him off stride. He never lost focus. And he's been training like hell. He seems to love the Churchill surface. So
Kurt,
I'm putting Zandon on top. And I'm going to say that Mo Dunnigal follows him down the stretch and picks up the place. And I think Messier finishes third.
Welcome back to Miller and Moulton, only on the Florida Sports Network.
Miller and Moulton, Florida Sports Network. We are just lining them up and knocking them down today. We are bowling for guests. That's what we're doing. Hour ago, Luke Smith talking F1. Top of the hour, Pat Kerwin talking NFL.
We did an F1 interview.
We did. It wasn't bad.
No.
Kurt Becker just gave you his ticket. 316 is what he's going with in the Derby.
Yeah, I got to shoot him a text and get his Oaks pick.
That's tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Keith Smith now to talk the association. Keith with NBA Spot Rack, Celtics blog. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's always our pleasure. Hey, is the Celtics-Bucks series come down to Milwaukee's going to win in the paint, so if Boston hits their threes, they win, and if they don't, they lose?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some truth to that. It's very hard to beat this Bucks team inside. They play with a great deal of size on both ends of the floor. They really prioritize defending the rim, taking away your paint touches and shots. And then on the other end, anytime you're going up against Giannis, he's going to do his thing around the basket area. So Celtics absolutely have to make shots. They have to be a little willing to work for those shots versus just coming down the floor, accepting the first one and letting it go. And that's something that they did a lot better with in game 2, and I would expect that to continue moving forward.
Yeah, there's no doubt they were chucking in game one, and it did not benefit them at all. Hey, this is not really in the playoffs thing, but we've been trying to, you know, Ben Simmons now is going to have back surgery. When did he hurt his back?
Yeah.
Originally, he hurt his back before the bubble. He had a back problem there. That's what kept him out of that first-round series in the bubble. He was out then, and then that was something that it was kind of like a lot of back issues for a lot of players. It kind of came and went and came and went, and then it worsened while he sat out and didn't take part in the early part of the year with Philadelphia. But originally, it was a couple years back in the bubble.
Man, it just seems to me, you know, then how did he pass the physical for the trade? I mean, it is weird, though, Keith. You do have to acknowledge a guy hasn't played in a year. Hell, he had one practice with the Sixers, eight with the Nets. I mean, seemingly, if his back was this bad, where he needs to have a disc repaired or replaced, and he's going to miss 3 to 4 months, how in the world are we just finding out about this a year, year and a half later, if you know what I mean? I mean, to us, it made it seem like, well, he's got a little bit of a bad back. No, man, he's got a disc problem. He needs significant surgery. I mean, one seems to be a lot more than the other.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head when you called it weird, because that's exactly what this situation is. It's one of those where, we might be looking back and saying, well, you know, maybe the Nets won this trade only strictly because of the Seth Curry and the picks part of this, because James Harden certainly doesn't look very good for the 76ers, and Ben Simmons, who knows, you know, when, if we'll ever see him play. And it really is, you know, one of those situations where it's kind of a mess on all sides. And then, you know, if you're the Nets now, you're hoping, all right, let's get this back surgery. Let's, you know, get you know, months of incorporating him, hopefully putting the support structure around him that he needs, and let's get after this. But it's one of those ones where, you know, right now this trade doesn't look great for either side.
No, and obviously, you know, Philly last night getting beat pretty badly, but I was more surprised by the fact that Harden's not taking a lot of shots. Without Embiid, I thought we'd see the James Harden that's going to put up 30, 35 shots, and yet I think he had 15 attempts last night from the floor.
Yeah, I think we all did. I think we all thought, you know, we'd either see him take, you know, 25, 30 shots, as you said, get to the free throw line a whole bunch and those kind of things. But there's a thought around the league is he's just not that guy now. He clearly doesn't have the same burst and explosiveness. He was never one of those people you looked at and was like, wow, that guy is a super athlete. But he was always quicker, stronger than he got a lot of credit for. And now it looks like a lot of that quickness just isn't really there. That's one of those things, if you're Philadelphia, you have to really be thinking hard about, all right, where are we going? Because this series isn't going anywhere unless Joel Embiid comes back and can absolutely dominate in starting in game three. This thing is pretty much done. So I think what we're going to look at with this is, you know, where are we going forward? Because is this a guy we really want to hand $60 million to 5 years from now when he's 37 years old, when he looks like this as a 32-year-old?
Well, I mean, this becomes a disaster. This was supposed to be one of the best chances that they have to win a title year, right, Keith? I mean, they were going to have Embiid and Harden at obviously the youngest they're going to be now. Maxey is a really nice third player, thank you very much. I mean, between Embiid's injury and Harden looking like he's, quite frankly, out of shape, I mean, this is a disaster for Philadelphia if this is a meek second-round playoff exit. This was supposed to be a really good shot to win the title year.
Yeah, it absolutely was. They were one of those teams that, when they made, at the time that they made that trade, it was seen as, all right, hey, even if Harden isn't peak James Harden, he's a heck of a lot better than the zero we're getting from Ben Simmons. And then, you know, their big loss in that trade, which is kind of underrated at this point, I think, is they gave up Andre Drummond, who was giving them really solid minutes, 10 to 15 minutes a night, could, you know, up his time up into the 20, 25, 30 range on the nights when Embiid sat. And then they didn't replace him with anything. Paul Millsap doesn't have anything left in the tank, it appears. And that was really, really rough for them. So I think, you know, now they didn't protect themselves properly with a guy who you kind of just feel like something's always coming with Joel Embiid injury-wise. And here we are. And yeah, you're absolutely right. This is one of those missed opportunity years where it feels like if you're Philadelphia, you start looking at, all right, is our window was open for about a half a minute there, and now is it already closed?
I mean, Mark, could you imagine if they made this deal and they actually don't offer him that five-year max extension? Okay, I mean, which is worse, offering it to him or making this huge deal and walking away from it so quickly?
I think it's actually walking away because it would show lack of knowledge from the front office. I mean, it would blow this trade up, and I think that would end up being worse. You know, it's hard. We want to get into talking about the Heat because, well, they're the one seed. They're up 2-0, but without Embiid, it's tough to think this series will be anything. But when you look at the Heat, is there a tougher out in the postseason? They play great defense. Butler's a star, but not the superstar the other teams have. I mean, they come at you so many different ways. This Heat team's a really difficult out, Keith.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And we knew with the way they played defense that they were going to be tough all the way through. Because if you play defense, you give yourself a chance every single night. Now, some nights the shots aren't going to fall and it doesn't go your way, but more often than not, you're going to be in every game if you defend the way they do. And they're able to find enough offense, you know, to figure it out, whether it's, you know, Jimmy Butler getting it going kind of in the mid-range and, you know, on drives to the rim, or they work, you know, Tyler Hero when Kyle Lowry's, you know, right and healthy. That's the worry now is anytime it's a hamstring injury, you start saying, yeah, that's rough, because those have a way of lingering and those kind of things. But I think that's part of why Miami is motivated here. Hey, let's take care of business. Let's get this series over and done with. So then we're sitting home, resting, recovering, getting right, and let the Celtics and Bucks beat up on each other, and then we'll take whoever's standing after that one's done.
Keith Smith, Spot Rack, Celtics blog, NBA front office show. Follow him on Twitter, Keith Smith NBA, Keith Smith NBA. Is this Phoenix's title to lose?
That's a good question. It probably, in some sense, I would, of all the teams that remain, I would give them the best odds of winning. They are the most complete team that is left. They really don't have any holes. They're very good defensively. Their offense just can find stuff. I always say with them, too, if you don't beat them in the first 43 minutes, you're not going to beat them because you're not going to get them in the final 5 minutes. And they, I mean, what they did last night to Dallas, at one point, it was 99-93. And then it was, I believe, the next time I really, you know, focused in on it, it had been like a 22-3 run for Phoenix, and they just put the clamps on Dallas and then pulled away, not making shot after shot. And Chris Paul is playing as good as he's ever played, which is, you know, incredible at his age and where he's at in his career, but he's just getting it done night after night. You still play the game at whatever pace he wants it to be played at. So, yeah, Phoenix is going to be really, really tough to get it. It's hard to see a team beating them 4 times in 7 games.
What injury out there is the most significant? I mean, Embiid's the most. I would say after Embiid, with Middleton out, now with Payton getting hurt. You know, there's a lot of injuries in these playoffs. First off, can the Bucks get through the series without Middleton? And is that the biggest injury really out there outside of Embiid?
Yeah, I think so. You saw how hard it's been on them offensively in the first 2 games. They really, in some ways, got fortunate that Boston played so poorly offensively in game one, because the Celtics turned it over a ton. The Bucks, almost half of their offense came through transition. And then in game two, when the Celtics didn't turn it over seemingly every other trip, and then they shut off the Bucks in transition, Milwaukee just couldn't score. And that's been the challenge for them. Chris Middleton is, Giannis is a whole different thing. He's going to create, you know, by basically, he's just going to go right through you like a bulldozer. But Chris Middleton is their best guy. When you're late in the clock, you throw him the ball, he's going to get you something good, whether it's a shot by him or he's going to create it for somebody else. Drew Holiday doesn't have that same kind of on-ball creation skills. And when the Celtics said in game two, we're going to single cover Giannis. If he beats us, so be it. But we're not going to give him all these open passes and everything we gave up in game one, shut down transition. You saw how hard it is for Milwaukee. So that is a serious swinging kind of injury, and it's made it really tough on the Bucks.
Keith, I think one of the most underrated pieces on the Celtics is Al Horford. Can you talk to me a little bit about how he is able to, him and Robert Williams are able to defend Giannis and Brook Lopez at the same time?
Yeah, I think what you have to do with Giannis, the book on him is, you want to play off him to invite the jumper. Everybody knows this. But the problem is, then all you're doing is creating a lane for him to get up ahead of steam, take two dribbles, and then he's on top of the rim already. I think what the Celtics have a little bit different with Horford, with Grant Williams, and then with Robert Williams kind of lurking around on the backside is they're able to play off him, but then meet him when he drives with size. And that's a little bit different. Other teams will try to play that game by playing off him and playing with a wing, you know, guarding him out there. So I think what we really look like with this is they're able to drop off. Then when he drives into the paint, they're there. Those guys are also big and strong enough to just take that, you know, those shots and hits to the chest and those kind of things. And then they're not going to bounce back. Where so many other guys, you know, he puts that shoulder into him, and the next thing you know, they're in the third row under the baseline, and he's putting the ball through the net.
No NBA playoffs tonight. The two series that we had last night will actually play again on Friday. The Milwaukee-Boston series, along with the Golden State-Memphis series, they are being held to the weekend for television purposes. Keith Smith, Spot Rack, Celtics blog, front office show. Follow Keith on Twitter at KeithSmithNBA. Keith, always appreciated. All the best with the family.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Keith Smith, kind enough to join us once again here on Miller and Moulton. This may be a really bad take. This is what I've been thinking when I've been looking at Harden. There are certain great players in sports who really didn't take care of themselves while they were great players. Lawrence Taylor did it for 10 years on just gifts from the gods and tremendous football instincts. John McEnroe had more talent and more instincts than anybody else. Yvon Lendl had the better career on paper because Lendl got into physical fitness and McEnroe didn't work out really for the first 10, 12 years of his career. And when I'm looking at James Harden, I'm seeing a guy who is not physically where the guys he's now competing at are. And he's now, what, 31? And he's been doing it over 10 years. And he can't just do it based on his natural talent anymore. He can't. He's got to get his ass in shape this summer. And he realized that, in my opinion, the rest of his career, dude, you ain't 26-year-old James Harden anymore. You ain't the Houston Rockets James Harden anymore. That guy's never going to be around. So you better get in better shape.
And his playmaking has not slowed down at all. He's still one of the best playmakers in the NBA.
I know, but you're paying him $50, $60 million a year. You got to give me 25 blanket points. You got to hit threes.
Yeah.
I'm just still in complete shock that you allowed Felipe to ask a question. I thought you wanted the time. You're trying to get his attention. And all of a sudden, he grabs the mic and starts asking questions. What the hell is going on? Is this Felipe Thursday around here? What is this? Is it a graduation present?
He raised his hand. He asked for permission. And I thought about it. And so far, he's had a perfect show. 4 for 4 with the guests. And I said, you can do it if you ask a short one. Miller and Moulton, I don't know if it'll happen again.